WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In the studio with me now is poet and novelist David Slavitt. David Slavitt also has a pseudonym, which is Henry Sutton, and he has written what he calls mildly salacious books under that name, books like The Exhibitionist and The Voyeur. In 1967, David Slavitt had two first novels, one published under each name. In 1978, two novels were published, one under each name. In all, there are 8 volumes of poetry, 7 novels under the name Slavitt, and 6 novels under his pseudonym. There is also a textbook that he published in 1976 called Understanding Social Life. David Slavitt is a graduate of Yale and Columbia. From 1958 to 65, he was an associate editor at Newsweek, where he was the film critic. He's presently, in addition to writing, teaching creative writing at Temple University Center City, and he's teaching a course in popular literature at Temple Sugarloaf. David Slavitt lives in Philadelphia. His new novel, under his own name, is called Joe Stern. Again, Joe Stern is the name of the novel, not a third name that David Slavitt uses. The book is about a woman who writes books which, with flashy publicity, become bestsellers. The woman is not unlike Jacqueline Suzanne. The story of Joe Stern takes place amidst much intrigue in the publishing world. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here, Terry.
Nice to have you here. Let's start off with your other name before we get to your real name. Why do you write with different names? Why is some of your work Henry Sutton and other of your work David Slavitt?
Well, I wonder. Originally, the theory was that it would be nice to make some kind of distinction between the two kinds of work and the two kinds of audiences, because they really have different audiences. And when Longines makes a cheap watch for wide sale, they call it a Wittenauer. And there's a commercial tradition for that, which is quite well established in Western capitalismo. The other literary way of doing it, which Graham Greene had tried, failed, clearly. He used to write an entertainment on Istanbul train or whatever that was. And then graduate students would spend enormous amounts of time and typewriter paper trying to prove that the entertainments were really more serious than the heart of the matter or the end of the affair. So that he finally gave it up, and it just made no sense. And I thought that, well, as you said, both of these books, The Exhibitionist and one you've never heard of called Rochelle or Virtue Rewarded, were coming out within a month of each other. And the way things are in the book trade, I figured that it was less likely that bookstores would order both books if they were under the same name. They would probably limit themselves to the one that had the enormous advertising and publicity budget. And so I had to protect one.
Book dealers don't know about this. They're never.
Oh, they found out later.
Uh-huh.
They found. I mean, there was a big thing about it in Life, and I was on all these talk shows and. I was revealed at an opportune moment. But partly to protect the other book and partly because it seemed reasonable to do, I tried the two different names. And in a way, it's partially backfired, I think. Reviewers now have the feeling when a Henry Sutton book comes in that this is, he is slumming and this is schlock. And when a David Slavitt book comes in, this is highbrow, low revenue stuff. We can ignore it. It will sell 9 copies. So I am hoist by my own petard, whatever a petard is. Or
well, since you've been revealed or were revealed at a formerly opportune moment, I mean, I would wonder why you're still using the pseudonym since, you know, the game's been revealed.
Any publishers.
Any book owner.
Publishers are not smart.
Uh-huh.
Publishers are.
Short-term memories.
Publishers are very dumb. They don't know a whole lot about business. Any executive in the scrap metal business who is running an equivalent amount of capital is getting 3 times what any editor in New York is getting. And they don't know a lot about literature either. They're English majors. So that...
Is that really true? Because the people I know who are English majors who are trying to get into the publishing world are basically being told that they're much too literary to ever have a job in publishing.
Well, most of the time that's true. I mean, if they really know how to read books, they're disqualified. Because the books that sell are obviously not the books that One of the first things I was ever given at Newsweek when I was a trial writer, I was handed a book and told to go home and either write a review of it or write a memo about why it should be ignored. And I went home and I read it and I compared it to all of the standards that I'd learned from Robert Penn Warren and people at Cleanth Brooks and people I'd studied with at Yale, and found it wanting. So I wrote a memo saying that Newsweek could ignore as an utterly valueless thing that would go nowhere, Exodus by Leon Uris. I was correct, but I was wrong. And this kind of thing, if you're being hired in a publishing house, can be very expensive. So they like people who were English majors but didn't do very well, who really like to read love story.
Well, I want to pursue that a little more later.
Sure.
Talking about the course that you teach on popular literature and how you choose books for that. But let's get back to the novels that you write. I had said that you had described your books under the Sutton name as being mildly salacious. I like the title The Exhibitionist and The Voyeur. They're two separate titles. I like that because they're both descriptive of the same thing. You know, like a voyeur would probably love to watch an exhibitionist. And somehow, like the reader of mildly salacious stuff is a voyeur.
Well, exhibitionists would be appalled if they were confronted by voyeurs. The whole point of exhibitionism is to shock.
I guess. Yeah.
So they but it's nice because I got my publisher to have both of those books hand-bound in leather, and it makes a wonderful set. It looks like, the Greek historians or the dialogues of Plato. It's boxed and everything. It looks gorgeous. Depressing. I have them in Hebrew. I have them in Finnish. They're not bad books, actually. If it's a good read.
What was mildly salacious in 67, and has that changed? I mean, has the...
Well, I had some unorthodox...
Has there been escalation in the work of Henry Sutton?
Well, actually, the new Henry Sutton, which is called The Sacrifice and comes out from Grosset and Dunlap, August 2nd, I think, is a novel of the supernatural and occult, and is, diabolist rather than Freudian or Havelock Ellis-esque, Ian-ish, whatever. Back in the late 60s, there was, we were at a kind of watershed. This is when Hugh Hefner was still airbrushing out pubic hair. And one could get a whole lot of mileage and a whole lot of notice just by being mildly bolder than anybody else had been in the last 3 months. I thought probably that I was a little dirtier than Valley of the Dolls and probably a little less dirty than The Adventurers. But mostly these things are a matter of social class. And attitudes are determined not so much by truly literate, liberated, intelligent people, but by a lower middle and middle class audience, which is what you get to if you have a wide sale. The Exhibitionist, I think, sold 3 million something. And at that moment, there was just enough in this to make them go, ah, did you see what was on page 246? Mildred, you wouldn't believe it. So Mildred, who was the next, at the next desk in the typing pool or wherever, or the next bench in the park with the prams, feels that maybe she better buy this book. It sounds good. And, that worked back then.
You're implying, I think, that people who get really excited by seeing stuff that they also find appalling will be attracted enough to that to want to read it, although may condemn it in real life.
It depends on how it's couched. The Exhibitionist was, after all, about Hollywood and the film business. And everybody's... We have the feeling, all of us, that we own these people. And probably we do. They are fantasy creatures, projections. If they don't do that, then they're not earning money at the box office and they disappear. We like to disapprove of them. It's rather like the Time Magazine Reader's Digest syndrome, which is a reverse of... They're the obverse and reverse of the same coin. The Reader's Digest likes to talk about animals that behave like people, people that behave like angels, old age and death or accidents. Accidents can be avoided. All you have to do is increase your word power and you'll become an unforgettable character and be loved by all. It glorifies the common man, and the commoner the better. Time magazine proves that politicians, artists, opera singers belch, pick their nose, have dandruff, and are no better than you and me. So that the success that, which is a very splashy, showy success, that Hollywood people have occasionally showered upon them, means that they're uppity. And so we like to see that they're paying for this in torments in the bedroom and with pills and liquor. And it proves that, you know, my boring life in Muncie, Indiana as a housewife is really, really, really better than whoever. Or whoever's.
I get the feeling that you see the readers of Henry Sutton books as being mostly women. Just from
I think the readers of fiction largely are women. I mean, the whole thing is just so depressing. You could weep. 50% of the adult literate American population reads less than one book a year. So if you see somebody reading a Jackie Suzanne novel in a bus, that's already an aristocrat.
Do you applaud when Anna Karenina makes it to the top of the bestseller list?
Has that happened?
Yeah, it has. Well, I don't know if it's the very top, but after public broadcasting, did the serialized...
Well, I avoided the public broadcasting serialization because I liked the book and I didn't want it messed up or fiddled around with. I think it's nice that Anna Karenina is selling well. You know, it would be even better if it were still in copyright and Tolstoy's heirs could get money from it. What the quality is of those readers, I can't guess. And I expect minimal.
If you said that you suspect most of the people who read novels at this point are women.
Most people don't read anything at all.
Right.
College
but
graduates read about 3.2 books a year. Most men will be reading biographies, how to fix your Volkswagen at home, books on issues, nonfiction stuff, you know, how to run, improve your sex life, diet. Because of, you know, we have not yet achieved equality between the sexes, and there are still a great many oppressed women who are oppressed by freedom, which is, you know, ought to be enviable. And so they have more time to read novels.
I'm trying to figure out what that means.
And they're more interesting to talk to at parties. People who really spend most of their lives, you know, and energies and attentions in some corporate enterprise tend to become very dull very quickly. So that, you know, there are...
How does that affect what you write? You know, how does that affect that feeling that most of the readers of this are going to be women who are not involved in corporate structure?
I don't think about it in any particular way. I think that in as much as they do read novels more than men do, they become adept at reading novels. I mean, it may be novels of a certain quality or character or lack of quality or character. But there are conventions of fiction, so that I keep in touch simply by reading enough contemporary fiction so that I know what we have a shared experience. The character in Joe Stern, who was a phenomenal success. I mean, you said not unlike Jackie Suzanne, and Jackie Suzanne was even more successful than Joe Stern. Jackie Suzanne had, I think, 5 books, bang, 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 each one at the top of the bestseller list. And whether we like it or not, she is the great American novelist. I mean, that's it. And what Joe Stern is about is the terrible contortion mentally that any other writer has to go through, any good writer has to go through, trying to figure out if she's it. If the great American novels are Valley of the Dolls, Jaws, The Godfather, and Love Story, what the hell am I doing in this business? To whom am I writing?
I'm going to...
I mean, Vox Clamantis and Deserto is all right, but this is a jungle. This is a pit.
There's a line in your novel, Joe Stern, where the narrator is kind of like describing the
narrator
writer.
Is cutely named Henry, yeah.
Yes. I was going to point that out. The narrator is describing her prose, and it's not a very loving description of the prose. And he writes, "Am I condescending? You bet I am. But Jesus, she just wasn't very good as a writer." I guess That's what you're asking yourself, too. Like, well, what's going on? Why is this selling when somehow the writing isn't good?
Sure. I spend a great deal of time reading crummy books and watching television because it's reassuring. I mean, if I've had a tough morning at the typewriter and I am just utterly shot by 1 o'clock and doubting myself, doubting my sentences and paragraphs, there's nothing so wonderful as to turn on 10 minutes of All My Children and figure that somebody wrote that, I mean deliberately. They were paid for it, probably more than I was paid for my morning's labors. And worst or best of all, it is being loved by offhand 30 million people at this moment. So if that's true, what do I have to worry about? You can also turn it the other way around, and if that's true, why am I doing this? To be a little more sophisticated about the prose, Joe Stern's prose is not very good. Neither was Jackie Suzanne's. Neither was Grace Metalius's. C- in any college creative writing course. On the other hand, you can also claim, I think rightly, that Dreiser's prose is pretty bad. If you read any particular page, if you read a chapter, it's tolerable, and if you read a whole novel, it's wonderful. The thing about these great popular successes is that the terribilitude of any particular paragraph is in no way relieved by the entire conception or structure of the book. The architecture is just as bad as the detail work. And this is awful. And, you know, I was right to have said Exodus will go nowhere. It should have gone nowhere. The poignant situation is that of a practicing artist in a democracy. Art is by nature aristocratic.
Well, I think what you're also saying, in Joe Stern anyways, is that in the publishing world, it's also a question of where the money is. You know, if the money's put behind your work, and if you're packaged well, and if your work is packaged well, your chances of success are much better. Because once something is singled out, once either a person or a product is singled out and, you know, much touted and constantly presented to a large audience, then, you know, a good percentage of that audience is going to, you know, if it's presented well, end up being interested in it.
Well, is that true?
I don't know. What do you think?
Probably not. I think that there are certain conditions where it can appear to be true. If you have a succès de scandale of the kind that Gore Vidal had with Meyer Breckinridge or Nabokov had with Lolita, you can get enough attention. You know, suddenly Newsweek and Time did cover stories on Nabokov. Nabokov had written Mary, a wonderful, a superb novel that sold maybe 300 copies when he was an émigré in Russia, and I guess he was 26 years old. You know, many, many, many years later, here is Mary, Book of the Month Club selection, which is, a minimum of $50,000 and a minimum readership of 140,000 people. You can't simply say that the success of Lolita was responsible for the esteem in which Nabokov was held in his latter years. What it did was to bring him to everybody's attention and suddenly broaden his audience. And you have to get to the attention of enough people so that those few who decide, you know, who's worth anything. Anthony Burgess wrote many, many, many novels. I mean, he thought he was going to die, and he was trying to build up an estate for his wife at the time, I think. And so he sat there grinding out novels at about the rate I'm doing, 3-4 a year. And then some doctor said, no, it was the wrong x-rays or something, you know, somebody else's EKG, you're fine. And he'd published 14, 15 novels, and most of them were out of print, and he was lucky to sell to paperback for $2,000 and little teeny printings. Suddenly, The Clockwork Orange was turned into a movie by Stanley Kubrick, and Burgess became a who-body, which is between a somebody and a nobody. And from that, somehow parlayed himself in, and now he reviews for the TLS, and he does, rewrites the Bible for Italian producers. And, is a great great wheeler dealer. And the question is how to get there. I once had a pleasant evening in Rome with Gore Vidal, and Gore told me that the thing to do is to become a celebrity. And it doesn't matter how you do it. Writing is only one way. The point is to become a joke on Laugh-In. As Lily Tomlin had a thing about Mr. Veedle. That's what made him.
But is it, I mean, that's not necessarily what one would want. I mean, you know, well, not everyone would define success in terms of being a joke on Laugh-In.
What is success? I mean, there are more people who recognize Farrah Fawcett Majors than recognize any living American writer. So is that what you want? Is that fame?
It's fame.
It's fame. But, you know, that passes. You remember, what's her name, Fannie Fox? There was, back in the month of Fannie Fox, there was not an American novelist, poet, anything, anywhere near so well known as Fannie Fox. It goes away. The hope, I think, is that you convert this into readers. And not all of them, but some of them will be your readers. And you want to do this not even so much anymore for private, personal ambition, but because you have the feeling about books that they're kind of like your children. You would like them to do well. You would like them to find their friends. You know, it can be a very, very long time. All of the poems of John Donne were essentially out of print for 200 years. And then in 1915, a couple of clowns in Oxford and Cambridge figured out, you know, he was not bad. We ought to do this again. And they were reprinted. Skelton went 300 years without having been read by anybody except, you know, specialists in English Renaissance literature. Mm-hmm. Suddenly he's read now by undergraduates, I suppose. I hope.
You have like three, you know, different writing personalities. The, you know, poet, David Slavitt, novelist, and Henry Sutton, novelist, and more in the mildly salacious category than Henry Sutton.
Well,
so like, are you going to a poetry reading at? You're scheduled to read soon at not the Smithsonian.
Well, I read at the Library of Congress.
Library of Congress, yes. I mean, you go to Library of Congress, a lot of very distinguished, bright people show up to read. I mean, do you like acknowledge the other?
Depends who they are and how they are. There are some soft-minded, soft-hearted people who think that this is scandalous and who disapprove of me and who give me heat. And they are uncomfortable, insecure, middle-brow types, and there's nothing to be done with them except, you know, put them out of their misery, which I generally do by being extremely rude, which is what they expect of me, and it's a perfectly satisfactory transaction on both sides. There are others who are more secure and relaxed, who figure out that it is necessary to survive, first of all, and that, you know, I couldn't probably make it as an insurance company executive, the way Wallace Stevens did. Therefore, I have to find some other livelihood. The fact that I do Henry Sutton novels from time to time doesn't mean that I've sold out. It's just that I've bought in enough to get groceries and gin. Faulkner used to go out and work for Howard Hawks and write, you know, the four or five words of dialogue in the Land of the Pharaohs, which is mostly building pyramids. They grunt a lot and move about large stones.
Right, there's always that argument that some people make, you know, that if you're writing or making music or doing whatever in two ways, one because, you know, it can make you money and it can sell, but it's not really your preferred language.
Well, I've never thought of it quite this way before, but I have the feeling that there may be some underlying sexual jealousy involved, because it's clearly a paradigm of that. If you do it with somebody else, then you've been untrue to me and you somehow fouled the whole nest. With this kind of thing, that has nothing to do with it. But the idea that I've been unfaithful to my readers and have had a flirtation elsewhere is grounds apparently for resentment. I mean, all I've done is written a different kind of book.
Right.
Nobody resents the fact that, for instance, that I translated this social psychology text into English, because that audience doesn't count. their captives and enrolled in some course in social psychology in some, you know, land-grant college. And they're out there trying to figure out that rich people generally tend to have more money than poor people, and that outgoing people tend to have more friends than reclusive people. If you the trouble with social psychology is that if you translate all of this into simple English, it becomes much of it too obvious to say. But nobody bothered about that, or that didn't upset anyone. And I think that that was a more unpleasant experience, and the expense to my spirit was probably greater than writing a Henry Sutton novel, which I enjoy. One of the things I learned when I was a movie critic, and I think, you know, it has been your experience, anybody's experience who's honest about it, is that you will sometimes go to the movies and realize intellectually that this is a piece of cheese. This is badly done, ill-conceived, sentimental, stupid, foolish, but I'm having a wonderful time, and I just adore it. And just as there is a category of the good, bad movie, there is also the category of a good, bad book. But apparently many people are still so imbued with the idea of a book as a sacred object.
I know exactly what you mean by the good, bad.
You can't have a good, bad book because that's disgraceful. It's all right in the movies because, you know, what the hell, it's only a movie. A book is a holy object. This is like the Bible and like Shakespeare and like the poems of Keats. And how can we be messing around like this, just enjoying ourselves, realizing at the same time that it's silly? So that when I write a Henry Sutton novel, it is absolutely essential that I enjoy it. Because if I didn't, I couldn't do it. As Robert Frost said once, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. No fun for the writer, no fun for the reader.
No, you're also teaching a course in popular literature in which you, like, choose from, you know, a huge number of good books and good bad books and bad books to present to your students. What are some of the books that you're teaching or going to be teaching?
Well, this coming...
What have you singled out from the wealth of popular American
this
fiction?
This coming term, we will be reading Valley of the Dolls. We'll be reading Hotel by Arthur Haley, which is like any other Arthur Haley book, but mildly shorter. The Agony and the Ecstasy. God knows. Maybe a Dashiell Hammett book, which is better, but genre. Death of the Fox by George Garrett, which is in fact a great novel that nobody knows about, or fairly few people do. The idea is that the essential thing in popular fiction, and what distinguishes it from serious, quote, academic fiction, highbrow fiction, is that popular fiction appeals to an external truth, the truth of correspondence. One reads The Godfather, and it only makes sense, or it only has impact to many of its readers, to most of its readers, if they have the feeling that this is the way it is in the mafia. This is what those people's lives are like. It's true. You read Valley of the Dolls, and you figure, my God, that has to be Judy Garland. Oh, how awful for her. That kind of thing. The intellectual novel, or the, you know, there's no real correct word for it, or precise word, but the highbrow novel depends on a truth of coherence, which is an artistic truth, and it is not absolutely necessary that we know whom Isabel Archer stands for. The whole point of Henry James or James Joyce, or that, you know, and James Joyce has a lot of correspondences. I mean, people who go around making elaborate maps of Dublin to show where Bloom went. But it doesn't draw on that. It doesn't depend solely on that. So that they're willing to take the truth of an equation or of a geometrical theorem, a truth of art, and that frees them somewhat from the assumptions that are necessary in popular fiction, which I think are mostly false, that the world is reasonable. The shape, the structure of any book on the bestseller list, unless it's a real fluke. You know, Saul Bellow can probably make the bestseller list now simply because he is a Nobel laureate, and enough libraries will buy him, and enough people will buy the book as a sacred object, whether they read it or not, just to put in their bookshelves. You know, I own this, and I'm okay. But for most of the books on the bestseller list, the structure will be one that would not have been in any way outrageous or startling or surprising to Galsworthy or H.G. Wells or any British or American writer before World War I, and our assumptions about the world were radically different then. We assumed that it was reasonable, that certain causes resulted in certain effects, that that was manageable. You try to do a novel now, and there have been, I think, some heroic attempts that deals directly with external experience. And you get Norman Mailer doing The American Dream, and in fact doing it like a 19th century novelist, selling the rights in advance and writing the thing serially for Esquire and going the whole Dickensian route. And being defeated by the fact that our public experience now is too complicated, too absurd, too inchoate, too bizarre, to be encapsulated in any coherent, reasonable chronicle.
What about bestseller books like Coma and all the Bermuda Triangle books, all the kind of like you wouldn't
those
believe
are
these catastrophe
those are weird
books.
In that they appeal to a slightly different impulse or vulnerability when life gets terribly bewildering, as indeed I submit that it clearly has been ever since World War II. Probably since World War I, except I wasn't paying attention, not having yet been born. But if we get a time when the economy is uncertain, inflation is puzzling, doesn't make any difference whom you elect, they seem to mess up in pretty much the same ways, and what do we do? One of the reassuring things is to come up with a sufficiently gripping, compelling, paranoid fantasy upon whom we can, blame everything. There are different paranoid figures. I think the entire supernatural vogue, which is still going on, mm-hmm. With Omen 2 and God knows what, and The Sacrifice, which is Sutton's new venture, is a way of saying there are malign forces around. Of course we are powerless. And it's not terrible that we feel bad because we're in this terrible stew without having known we were getting into it, and of course that's the way it is. Coma is a way of saying that the doctors, who are authority figures, power figures, are crazy, are malign, are terrible. If they are terrible, if we can't trust our doctors, then of course we can't trust our lawyers, our politicians, our teachers, our mayors, Then at least it's all coherent, and we know how bad it is.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore it's reassuring, because we can see that everybody is scared silly. And I think that's the phrase is peculiarly accurate, scared silly. So into the kind of silliness of Coma or Jaws, there's a big shark out there. Okay, so don't go in the water. End the book.
When a popular literature course is taught at a university, in some universities, when the popular literature course is first brought in, some of the academics there are just ready to fall into a swoon, that's the end of the English department, now we're going to teach popular literature. Of course, some of the most, respected critics and writers in the country teach courses like that. But still, there's always that chance that people are going to be like, mildly surprised.
I was quite pleased by the attitude at Temple. They seemed to be not undergoing any crisis of identity. They know what they're doing. They know the difference between peanut butter and not. They can tell which is the shinola. And it doesn't bother them. I think the way in which I teach the course is very helpful, because I do occasionally advert the attention of my students to good books and try to tell them the difference. The courses obviously are popular. It's kind of kicky to take a course where you're reading Savage Surrender by Natasha Peters, which in fact we will be doing. Walk around carrying this book. This is for a course. Great. So, but if they can make a profit on this course, then they can subsidize the course in, let us say, Old Norse, which is probably less popular, or Beowulf, or satirists of the Regency. So it evens out. No great harm is done. And I think that what I'm fundamentally teaching is a balanced attitude about books, how to be comfortable about them, what to respect in them. You know, the whole question of literature in sort of big, shiny Gothic letters is a puzzling one, and I think it's Leslie Fiedler who has a curious idea that in the latter part of the 18th century, when the middle class was burgeoning because of the Indus Rev and the Agric Rev and all that, there was suddenly felt a need by these new middle-class people of three things. They needed dictionaries so they could spell correctly, which never bothered Shakespeare, never bothered aristocrats. They spelled more or less the way it sounded, and who was going to say that was awful? They needed books of etiquette, because they wanted not to mess up with which fork and which spoon and what the livery should be and how they should dress and how do you write to a bishop and all these things. And then they needed criticism, because once you've learned how to go through the rituals of a dinner party, there comes a time when somebody says, shall we join the ladies? And then they have a general discussion about whatever. And you're supposed to know what's good and what isn't. So that it was the same kind of help for the insecure, upward-aspiring middle class, and that, which is why Dr. Johnson is the first practical real critic. Before that, you have people, you know, Philip Sidney's Defense of Poetry and Aristotle's remarks about how it might work in tragedy if this and this happens. But practical criticism, as we know it, begins then for that reason. The academies have taken it over. And it works in a very, very, you know, simple correspondence that which is taught in universities is literature, and that which is not is not. And practically, as far as the publishers are concerned, you know, I have one course, but it means that suddenly 35, 40 copies of whatever I pick will be sold in a week in September. If there are 10 courses like this, that means 400 copies. If there are 1,000 copies, it means 1,000 courses of 4,000 copies. 4,000 copies is your break-even point on a novel.
Do you accept that view of criticism? I mean, do you think that criticism is tied to a middle-class need to know what's supposed to be acceptable and supposed to be unacceptable, supposed to be good, supposed to be bad? Because literary criticism has become so intellectual and so much about the details of individual words and meanings and relationships to other difficult texts that it's hardly a party pursuit, really.
Mm. Depends on who's writing criticism and for whom.
Like film criticism, for instance, is, you know, go see the film or don't go see the film in a lot of publications.
Essentially,
it's kind of consumer guide.
Essentially, that's all I want to know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, having been a film critic myself, I know that I don't trust anybody else. If the film is good, there's nothing they can do to help it. I don't need anybody to explain the damn thing to me. And if the film is not good, but amusing, I used to trust Brendan Gill because he was witty and civilized and funny, and he was comfortable enough to say that this is a terrible movie and I enjoyed it. So I trusted him a little. I don't trust Pauline Kael at all. Penelope Gilliatt, some, you know, a little bit.
But, okay,
but as far as the middle class and what's all right goes, you have to figure that the whole point of American education these days, alas, is to certify people into the middle class. And that if you were to award everybody at, let us say, 14 days of age, a baccalaureate degree, you would reduce the college enrollment by probably 85%, because they wouldn't need to go to get the damn thing. They could just go directly to work for IBM or Coca-Cola or Amalgamated Widgets. This would take out all kinds of deadwood, because the only people who would be left are people who are interested in the subjects that are in fact being taught. It would do away with probably 85% of the universities and colleges in this country. Also a good thing. These are draconian measures, but one of the difficulties that we have is that the social role, I mean, the whole business about the Bakke case yesterday, the reason that it's important is not that there are these people who are desperate for knowledge, but that the social role of universities has been distorted and warped beyond all anything that any 18th, 19th, early 20th century scholar could have supposed. I mean, the Bakke thing is a little different because that was a medical school question. But aside from the learned professions, law, medicine, the clergy, and teaching, before World War I, very few people went to college, and for peculiar reasons, mostly because they liked to read old French or were interested in astrophysics. Or
what you're saying is giving me mixed feelings on a personal level, in the sense that you're being very critical, I think, of a lot of people who have not attended college or who have attended college strictly to get the better job and not to kind of get a more field sensibility. Yet a lot of the books that you sell are probably to those very people who have not been to college.
Well, there are more of them.
But don't you feel a little uncomfortable, or should you feel uncomfortable, or should you not feel uncomfortable, kind of criticizing on one hand and selling to another?
No, I'm not. Well, I'm criticizing how. I'm saying that the reason that we have universal compulsory literacy, education in this country, used to be so that you could have an enlightened electorate. Probably with television, this has become extraneous. Most people form their opinions about the candidates from seeing them. It wasn't the position papers of Kennedy that won. It was because he had charisma or whatever and photographed well. And Nixon's makeup man was not right. So that all of that political justification is by the boards a long time ago. There are no more literacy requirements in most states, I think, for voting. So the reason... compulsory education through, the age of 16 or 18 or whatever it is, does mostly is artificially to deflate the unemployment rolls. The burden that has been put on colleges and universities for certifying people into middle-class jobs is unfair to them, to the people. I mean, it ought not be necessary to have a degree from Villanova or wherever in order to get a job in a shoe store. Or in order to get a job selling space or time or whatever these people do, walking around looking earnest and wearing ties and carrying briefcases. I think it's cheating them of 4 years of their lives that could have been more profitably and amusingly spent. And the reason that the corporations like these people, I mean, they adore people who went to college as time servers, because if they put up with nonsense there for 4 years, then they will put up with corporate nonsense. And if they invested that much time and effort, then their social expectations will be higher. If their social expectations are higher, their absenteeism will be less, their sick rate will be, they won't change jobs, they'll be mortgaged up to their eyeballs. They will be wonderful, malleable personnel units. I don't think this is the desirable humanitarian object of these presumably intellectual academic institutions. These are not the humanities. And so these people, I'm not putting them down. I'm considering what's happening to them and the bitter unfairness of it. I think there's nothing wrong with, books for large numbers of people. And as I say, I couldn't write them if I didn't like them.
Mm-hmm.
Myself, in some way. I read other books, too.
What do you read? What have you been reading lately?
What have I been reading lately? I just finished the new book of poems of A.D. Hope, who is absolutely splendid. He's a great comfort to me because he's probably one of the three or four best poets writing alive in English. And it used to distress me when I would go into bookstores. I mean, not just chains, but good bookstores. Look at the poetry shelf and see I wasn't there. Then I figured out that there were other people I could look for, like A.D. Hope or George Garrett, who also weren't there. And if they weren't there either, then it wasn't an affront to me. It was just an affront. And generalized public affronts one manages to deal with easily enough. I've been reading some Thomas Berger lately, who is Teddy Villanova, is terribly funny. And Sneaky People is a terrific book. I read Borgelli's new book, Now Playing at Canterbury, which is brilliant. It's very, very good. Robert Penwarren's poems are a continual source of delight and amazement to me. And he gives me hope in another way. Because, good Lord, he must be 75, 6 now, maybe 78. He just gets better and better. And this means that even though I may grump and grouse about not having the other way of doing it, if you don't do it the way Gore Vidal said and become a joke on Laugh-In or a frequent guest on Johnny Carson, the other way of doing it is just to wait them out.
Uh-huh.
And if you stand in line long enough, perhaps they won't move the store. And eventually somebody will notice you and tell a friend, and they'll tell a friend, and like that ad for whatever the hairspray is or the shampoo.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, with
there's more and more heads on your television set. Well, listen, for those of you just tuning in, I'm speaking with David Slavitt, who is a writer. He is a poet, a novelist. Some of his novels are written under another name, which is Henry Sutton. He lives here in Philadelphia, also teaches courses in popular literature and creative writing at Temple University. I'd like to ask you, if I may, I don't know if you're in the mood to do this or not, but if you are up to reading us some of your own poetry, I'd surely like to hear.
Oh, that would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. That's like asking Casanova whether he's in the mood for another activity, but he's, of course, always in the mood. That's too long.
Well, while the pages are turning, I'll remind you that you're listening to Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 12 minutes to 5 o'clock.
This is a one-page thing that ought to be all right. It's called Everglades Bird Walk. Ground fog at dawn, the glades, like sleepy women, wake to the softness of bedclothes. A flash of pink, a roseate spoonbill, or blue, a heron. Thoughts in the early morning mind that cross like birds and vanish. Where do they go for the rest of the day? Peculiar country. Needlefish make patterns on the water's surface, signals of the nerves we cannot understand in our thick boots, tramping around with binoculars. Invading? Surely we are much too clumsy for spies. The sun comes on, comes into its own, warms, burns the vapor off to leave clear sailing for turkey vultures, and look, a red-shouldered hawk. We go for coffee, having seen, what? More than birds. If poets imagine a country in which the folk songs are their poems, this feels like the place it could happen. We explore with flag in case, looking to settle ourselves.
Could you read another?
Sure. This one is cute. The Lemmings. Food short against... This is from, a long time ago. I must have been in my early 20s. So it's about 20 years old. Food short against the long day's hunger, sunset a fatty morsel in the western broth, and sick of racing the birds and the tides on the sand spit for bits of edible sea wrack at which to pick. It seems no more unreasonable one day to try at last that sea which somewhere reaches a western landfall where each footfall may fester with food, where it rolls down the beaches. Thus their Columbus argues, convincing them, for who has the strength to discuss or even care? Slowly, like a tide, they begin to swim westward in the nobility of despair. And if they never return, who can say the conclusion is the obvious drowning it probably all comes to, who has stared for 20 minutes at the horizon where the herring silver touches the herring blue?
The poems that you've been reading are from a volume...
Vital Signs.
Vital Signs.
Which is still just barely in print. Doubleday did it, and as an act of kindness, I think, they haven't remaindered them all. You know what happens to books that don't move these days? Ordinary shelf life of a novel is now 10 weeks. 10 weeks, if nothing has happened, they either dump it at Encore or Marlborough or places like that, or, because the most valuable part of the book is its paper, they pulp them and they turn them into boxes in which other books are shipped. Cannibalism. Terrible. Terrible.
Some of the books being shipped now are being shipped very fancily. There's some incredible tie-ins going on in the publishing world now.
Well,
perfumes by the same names as the books.
Oh, they'll do anything, sure.
Prizes to the book dealers when they open up the cartons.
That was probably one of the things that that made some interest with the exhibitionist. There were some mildly sexy scenes where these kids were fooling around with the Polaroid camera, which obviously was the reason for the success of the Polaroid camera. You did not have to take your intimate pictures to the drugstore to be developed. And Bernie Geis figured out that he would give a Polaroid camera to any dealer who's, you know, either sold so many or had a window display that looked terrific or whatever. So the Polaroid cameras were thrown around, and the book did well. In fact, Felix Salten, who wrote Bambi,
yeah,
also wrote in his old age a wonderful pornographic novel called The Confessions of Josephine Mutzenbacher, which was probably the first pornographic novel. Oh, I love it. The first pornographic novel to rely on photography as the shtick. But he didn't know that. That's all right.
Okay, well, we are about out of time. I want to thank you very much for being here this afternoon, for sharing with us your thoughts, for reading some of your poetry for us. I've been in the studio with David Slavitt. He is a novelist and a poet, lives in Philadelphia, teaches at Temple University. Thank you again for being here.
Well, thank you, Terry.
This is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.